Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host on this weekend show. I also want to remind everybody, please visit our website, kereport.com, throughout the week because, this whole year actually has been very, very busy and every day I'm publishing anywhere from, 5-6 interviews a day, trying to keep everyone up to date on companies and market moves. I'm kicking off this weekend show with Mike Larson, editor of the Safe Money Report, one of my preferred guests to put on the weekend show to cover more in a broad sense, more from a generalist aspect, what's happening in these markets. Now, Mike, you and I are recording this late in the day on Thursday, so we don't know where the markets close, but one thing that I think we can all take away from the trading action in Thursday is this broad sell-off across the board, a lot seeming to be on the back of Jerome Powell's comments from earlier today on Thursday. Let's break down Powell's comments. Why and what did Powell say that you think is moving these markets and scaring investors out?
No problem. It's actually kind of funny because back on, I guess it was the 22nd or 23rd when Powell was giving his testimony in Congress, I was listening to what he was saying. I was thinking about how the markets had been sort of, weak and on pins and needles for a while, the bond markets it is. And I kind of came to the conclusion that the Fed, given rising inflation pressures and concerns, given the economic recovery we're seeing off the worst of the COVID lows, and given especially all the massive stimulus spending that's coming down the pike and that we've already seen from the Biden administration, what the market really wanted to hear was some kind of sop toward inflation concerns, reassurance that the cops are still on the beat, so to speak. I mean, the Fed has really been sounding almost extremely democratic and progressive in terms of the comments they're making, i.e., we don't care about inflation, and we want to wait till every last person has a job, there's a chicken in every pot, we're going to let things run hot, we're not going to raise rates premature, and so on and so forth. It's been very much hand in glove with sort of the Biden administration's fiscal policies. But the bond market in the last month leading up to that was really starting to rebel against that, looking for a little bit more of a, hey, we appreciate your concerns. We recognize the economy is improving. We probably want to start changing our messaging. But the Fed just didn't get it. And I tweeted out on the 23rd during his testimony, I said, I wouldn't be surprised if we got a reverse taper tantrum. And by that, I mean, if you go back to 2013, the bond market had a taper tantrum because Ben Bernanke started saying, oh, maybe we can unwind, dial back the QE. Maybe we'll have to raise interest rates at some point. And he was saying that at a point when the market was not expecting that. So the market rebelled. Interest rates went up. Stock market went down and so on a message that the Fed might prematurely, in the market's view, tighten. This time around, Fed did the exact opposite, said, no, we're not going to prematurely tighten. We're going to keep QE. We're going to, keep rates low. We want to promote employment. We don't care about inflation, blah, blah, blah. And then what did you get? The same result, a taper tantrum in stocks and bonds. And the reason is that I think this time the big difference is there's tons of fiscal aid being and deficit spending being thrown at the economy and the market. So what the market wanted was some, again, the cops are on the beat messaging. We're concerned. We feel your pain, so to speak, about, what you're worried about. And the Powell didn't deliver that either in his testimony or in his comments on Thursday. So what happened? Bonds tanked, stocks tanked. The market got even more skittish. So in other words, Powell's fumbling the ball here, but he's fumbling it in the exact opposite way, yet having the same impact that Bernanke did in 2013. It's very ironic, but I think that, that's exactly how things are playing out here.
So, Mike, what do you think it takes to get Powell to do more, to make the Fed more active in these markets?
Well, the problem, it's ironic here because in Powell's messaging, he basically said, we're not too worried. We're not going to do anything unless markets get unruly and unless that, they move fast enough, interest rates move fast enough to tighten financial conditions. What happens when you say, we don't care until bad things happen? Bad things happen. The market tests you, and then you're forced to react. I mean, I don't know if Powell is just being overly academic about this. I don't know if it's just misreading the room, so to speak. But I really, really was adamant in the last week and a half, 2 weeks, that, given what's happening in the markets, given the economic environment, the Fed needed to change its messaging and change it fast, or it was going to risk having an unruly market. It was going to risk having the comfortable move in interest rates become uncomfortable. the rise in interest rates, accelerate and get to such a magnitude that it impacted other markets. And that's exactly what we've seen. What my expectations have completely played out. So again, the Fed really is dropping the ball here, and hopefully they'll get back on course, or we're going to have even worse results, when I say even worse results, I mean bigger declines, and especially some of these way overheated parts of the market that were relying on promises of easy money forever and no pushing back from the bond market. You look at some of these tech names, the Teslas, the ARK investments of the world. There's a lot of super overvalued, super high-octane parts of the stock market that have really benefited from the bond market working hand in glove with the Fed and the Biden administration. But, you know, the gloves fell off, if you will, at the beginning of February. And that means that certain parts of the market are really in some trouble here.
So when it comes to that whole trend that we've been talking about, this rotation within the markets, a day like today on Thursday is a good example of money just flooding out of the markets. The broad averages are down. Really, the only thing that I'm seeing that is up is the U.S. dollar and oil. Oil is a whole other discussion that I'll get to later in this show. But when it comes to where money's going, where do you see money fleeing to?
Yeah, what's very interesting is from September through maybe the end of January, you saw money rotating out of some of the more defensive yield-oriented stuff like utilities, consumer staples, and into things like financials, industrials, and so on, and as you mentioned, energy as well. What started to happen, though, when you look kind of, I was preparing this month's Safe Money Report issue, and I was looking behind the scenes at different sector performance. What you saw is starting in early February, the very beginning of February, financials kept on going, but you started losing many more sectors. It wasn't just your obvious sort of utilities and some REITs that were losing ground relative to the market, and it wasn't just consumer staples. You started losing healthcare. You started losing tech. You started losing other sectors, and it was pretty much just financials that were still going up. So that was a divergence that kind of foretold some rockier times. Now that's what we're seeing. So I mean, this isn't exactly a genius observation given what's happening in the market. We obviously need to see the rate market get tamed if we're going to see more forward progress in stocks overall. It's gotten to the point where instead of just leading to shifting behind the scenes from sector, lagging sector to leading sector, to actually money coming out entirely, and that's what we've seen again. That's when interest rates go from being a diversion, a thing in the background that only impacts some assets and some sectors, into a real problem for the averages as a whole.
So as much as we can look at the economic data, it doesn't seem to at least impact what the Fed is doing, and hasn't for a little while now. It's more market moves. But one other thing that is, I think, playing a little bit of a role in just how optimistic people were getting and maybe the Fed staying on the sideline is the whole concept of this whole economic restart in the U.S. Even Texas this week announced that they're essentially reopening. How critical is it to watch what happens in Texas and this continued move in the U.S. towards, I guess, vaccinating everyone and getting the economy back restarted?
Well, there's certainly reason for optimism on the vaccination front, on the economic front. I mean, I know I'm ready to get on a plane and ready to get on a cruise ship at some point once it's safe and I'm vaccinated and so on. And I know I'm not alone. I mean, we all want to sort of restart our lives and get back to some semblance of normalcy that we had, 13, 14 months ago. And we're getting closer to that point. When you throw fiscal aid at the economy, you're turbocharging growth in the short to intermediate term as well, because you're giving people money they're going to go out and spend. The problem is, again, the Fed is sort of not acknowledging and or recognizing that shift in reality and sort of, easing the process a little bit, again, speaking to the bond market's concerns. And when you try and get that, when your messaging is off from what the market is sort of leaning towards, that's when you get these disconnects. That's when you get these tantrums. That's when you get these, sort of violent short-term moves. So, hopefully the Fed's going to kind of get it, so to speak, and, change its tune. And if it doesn't, then again, we're going to expect more of the kind of action that we saw this week.
Let's shift over to commodities, starting with precious metals, because gold continues to be under pressure, had a bad end to the week 2 weeks ago. This week isn't doing very well for it. When do investors start to move back into the precious metals?
Look, I mean, it's obvious that rising interest rates, rising real rates, meaning inflation-adjusted ones and so on more recently, that's been the headache for gold, and that's been, to a lesser degree for silver. Obviously, silver's economic sensitivity to industrial uses kind of helps it relative vis-a-vis to gold. especially when you look at things like copper. So, I get the concerns. I get why it has been underperforming. But at the same time, I think, especially in sort of a still chaotic market environment, an environment where these violent moves can come out of nowhere, you're going to have some safety demand for that. And really, honestly, in terms of the long term, whether it's inflation, whether it's monetary inflation, whether it's just sort of a safety valve, given how much money is being printed and borrowed and spent here in the U.S. and other countries, I think that you still have a very solid long-term case there. So again, it depends if you're a trader or an investor. And I mean, from an investment standpoint, this bull market started in the back half of 2018. I still think we're probably only in the fifth inning of it. So I wouldn't do anything. Shorter term, you've got to get some relief in the rate market. And I think once you do, if we do get that relief in the rate market, we're going to see some violent upside in terms of the shorter term for precious metals as they reprice or deprice that interest rate risk.
Okay. So again, a lot of eyes on the bond market. What about commodities broadly then? Base metals had been screaming higher, but they're starting to pull back as well. How does that play into this whole picture, the whole market environment?
Sure. I mean, you've got things like oil, that especially the recent OPEC news, where they're going to keep production cuts in effect for longer than I think the market was hoping for. That's put more strength in the oil market. Again, going back to what we said earlier, things like resuming travel, jet fuel, gasoline demand going up. That's helping to underpin what's going on in sectors like energy. And copper, it's partly a housing play. Low interest rates help there. If rates go up too much, you might get some bleeding or a little bit of letting the air out of that part of the market. But in general, I mean, the economic type commodities and metals are outperforming precious, and they're still doing well because you're getting the validation of the economic growth, the rebound, the vaccination process, and so on. Plus, I mean, if the bond market allows him to, the next thing the Biden administration wants to pivot towards is infrastructure. You're starting to get those media leaks towards that sort of attitude there, that's going to be the next priority if and when they get this $1.9 trillion broader stimulus in the can. So that's what I think, that too, again, would obviously support a lot of the sort of the economically sensitive commodities if we truly can get that kind of stuff through Congress.
So is now the time to be defensive then with your money? See how this all plays out? Because quite frankly, there seems to be fear creeping into the market, and fear can bring down every sector.
What I did in the Safe Money Report, I did actually peel a little bit of exposure off, sell a couple of stocks just to lower that a bit. I've been paring down interest rate exposure for several months and sort of rotating into growthier type things. So I've been adjusting. I'm not a real panic point yet, because I'm not exposed to some of this overvalued, overhyped, garbage type companies that have really been doing a dot-com impersonation. If I owned that kind of stuff, I mean, if I was overexposed, my portfolio was chock full of EV companies and Tesla and, ARK investments and these sort of micro and small cap tech names, I'd be panicking, because that kind of stuff is so overinflated that there's a lot of air that can come out. But if you're in more safe money type names, you're in some of these, cyclicals and value type companies, which are finally starting to show a little more promise after being left for dead for so long, I don't think you have as much to worry about. Even if you go back to the dot-com bust, while tech was falling apart the first year of the tech bust, tech ended up being down 40% or something. You saw utilities, REITs, and some of these value type sectors actually rise in value or just basically hold their own. So I think that, we could see more of that rotation behind the scenes. And so as long as you own the right kinds of stocks, I don't think you want to be running for the hills. I think you'll be okay. But I am, like I said, getting, dialing things back a bit.
Yeah, fair enough. It looks like you're not alone in these markets. Mike, it's great having you on the show. I hope everybody enjoyed this first segment. I am going to be back and discussing a bit more on some of these commodity moves for the rest of the show. But Mike, it's always great having you on the show. I really appreciate your time this weekend.
Thank you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am chatting in this segment with Mark Chandler. Mark is the managing partner over at Bannockburn Global Forex. Also writes the blog Mark to Market. We are going to spend a bit more time looking at the general markets, really taking a big picture look at what is happening for markets and some other sectors that are pretty critical. Mark, let's get into some of the news events from this week that contributed to the market moves. We first had Jerome Powell speak. We actually had a lot of other Fed presidents speak, but it was really Powell's comments that seemed to move markets the most and move them down. And we also had the U.S. non-farms payroll out that added more jobs than what was expected, 379,000 jobs added. Let's start with Powell's speech, though. Powell really did just confirm that the Fed is still going to be standing, for the most part, on the sidelines. No policy changes right now. What's important to note about what Powell had to say?
Yeah, I think that the most important takeaway from Powell is that the rise in U.S. interest rates is not a major concern to Fed officials, which means they're not going to do anything about the increase in yields. Like some people are talking about yield curve control or Operation Twist, where they buy more of the long end and sell the short end. I think that Powell's pretty clear, and I don't think that they haven't changed the tune, which I think alone represented some concern for the markets. Here, in the last few months, we've had the Treasury have these huge stimulus plans. We've got another one going. The market has revised up Q1 GDP, revising up all of this year's outlook for the U.S. economy. And the Fed says, and Powell says specifically, that we're a long way away from reaching our goals. And so what this means is that even as the economy, and we're talking about, you've seen some of these GDP now forecasts, anywhere between, say, 6 and 8.5% GDP growth, and the Fed says they're going to still be buying $120 billion worth of bonds every month. And so I think that the market works something like this. The Federal Reserve says, the chairman says, you haven't reached our pain threshold yet. Even though the volatility caught our attention, you haven't, the yield level hasn't, it doesn't bother us. And that is like waving a flag. And the market says, if we haven't found your pain threshold yet, we're going to fish for it. And I think that's what we're in the process broadly of doing, fishing for the central bank's pain threshold. When do they say the rise in yields is problematic or counterproductive?
Now, this rise in yields, it's come from the long end. And usually the Fed controls more of the short end. That's what has a lot of people talking about some sort of yield curve control announcement. But Powell hasn't said that they're going to do that. So where does that balance lie here, Mark?
Yeah, so I think that in some ways, you know, the steepness of the yield curve is one way to think about the profitability of lending. And so this steepness of the yield curve, and the yield curve is not just about the long end rising, but we have some technical issues relating. I think we talked about this before, about the Treasury reducing their cash position at the Federal Reserve. And what's happening is that some short-term U.S. interest rates go negative. For example, we don't often think about this, especially on the retail side, but it's called a repo and general collateral. And so what you're looking at is, if you're a bank, you hold treasuries, and you want to swap those treasuries for cash. Because the collateral rate is negative, you get paid to do that. And that's just, I use that just as an example to illustrate how steep that yield curve really is. The very short end has gone negative. It wavers back and forth, and some instruments are still negative. And so I think that the Federal Reserve, again, I don't think it's too upset by the yield curve. Remember, a year ago, 2 years ago, before COVID, people were concerned that the yield curve was too flat. And now they're concerned it's too steep. And I think that steepness, not only is the Fed saying this, but we'll hear it again next week, I think, from the Bank of Canada. And that is that the rise in yields, it reflects market optimism about what's going to happen when we've got herd immunity, or when we can go back to whatever normal is. And I think that partly it's a self-serving explanation, and partly because it basically says that officials are right. We're doing the right things for people to become more optimistic. On the other hand, one of the key events last week that you didn't mention as we talk about the Fed and U.S. jobs data, something else that happened just before Powell spoke last Thursday is OPEC surprised us. OPEC, many people like myself, thought OPEC, well, of course they're going to boost output. Oil prices were north of $60 a barrel. The OPEC Plus had cut 7 million barrels of oil from production. Of course they were going to let some bleed back into the market. But lo and behold, OPEC says no. They're not going to boost production. And so oil prices jumped by about 4% or so, and now they're jumping even further today. We're talking about $65 a barrel, more or less, for oil. And I find that, as simplistic as this may sound, rising oil prices fuel American expectations for inflation by measured by like break even and those kinds of things. So when Powell spoke and didn't express much concern about the rise in yields, he was really pushing on an open door, if you will, and that door had already been opened that day by OPEC's decision. So you've got the Federal Reserve, like other central banks, not so concerned about the level of interest rates. They specifically say that they don't target the long-term rates. They're concerned about financial conditions. So you have Powell, you've got the OPEC, and then you had what was a jobs report that was roughly twice what the market expected.
Let's dive into that jobs report, because in the next segment, I will be covering more of the energy and oil sector. But that jobs report, 379,000 jobs added. You and I were talking about this before recording, and there's some nuances within this number that we do need to understand. Please share with us what you're seeing within this jobs number.
Sure. The jobs number was very strong. The headline, 379,000. The market expectations were creeping up. We were around 200,000. But we know that the government sector lost jobs. The private sector itself gained about 465,000 jobs. This is a very strong number, like I say, well above expectations. But when you dig below it and you look at which sectors benefited, there's one sector that stands out, the leisure and hospitality sector. And that reflects the reopening in some places of the economy. That sector created 355,000 jobs. It's an amazing number, because we're not fully there yet, right? We haven't really fully opened up, even though some small pockets have. This is pretending, if you will, or suggesting what's in store for us. Perhaps when we get this month's report, there's already talk of over 1 million jobs. On the other hand, when you listen to what Powell says and what other central banks, not just in the U.S., but around the world, say, they're still concerned about the labor market. In the U.S., both Powell and Yellen have talked about the unemployment rate really being closer to 10% than the 6.2% that was reported today. So maybe another way to think about the damage of the labor market, because we don't want to confuse ourselves thinking the economy is the same as the labor market. We can have jobless recoveries. And here's what it looks like. The number of people who've been unemployed for a long term, which is 27 weeks, stands at 4.1 million. That's up 125,000 last month. So even though we had a lot of job creation, that's really good. On the other side of it shows us the longer term damage, and that is a rising number of people that are unemployed for a long period of time. Now, so we have 4.1 million on this long-term unemployed. This is up still 3 million from a year ago. And so if you ask, will the employment data, so strong, so much stronger than expected, will this change the Fed's view? And I say probably not. We'll see. The Fed meets on March 17th. And I think that this jobs number does not really alleviate concerns that the labor market remains scarred from this pandemic that we're still maybe winding down, but we're still in the middle of.
Okay, let's talk about market reactions then, because this week especially, we are starting to see some weakness in the markets. You and I are recording this on Friday, and it does look like these markets have bounced back from some of the weakness just today, but overall, I am seeing just simply more weakness. But that's then going hand in hand with what looks like, or at least optimism around the economy. kind of different from last year. Last year, the markets were really good and the economy sucked. And then this year, the economy is projected to get better and now the markets are looking weak. This does all tie into expectations on Fed easiness. But what's your balance here of these markets and how they are starting to look weak again?
Yeah, so I think that a couple of factors, considerations are important. One is that perhaps we're just at this inflection point where the market is, you know, one of the things when you think about the valuation, these fair value models of the stocks, you're really discounting the earnings stream. And interest rates is the discounting factor. And so when interest rates are low, the discounting function is low, and it could justify higher multiples. But now, as interest rates are rising, people have to readjust their models. And I think that there's this rotation taking place. And so those stocks that benefited from the very low interest rates, like the tech sector, people are liquidating those. But what are they buying? Well, I'd say two sectors. One is banks. Remember that yield curve, that steepness of the yield curve, which I suggest is one metric of the profitability of lend, has all of a sudden become much more profitable for the banks to do their business. And so we've seen the bank indexes, individual banks do very well in this environment. And the other thing that people like, I think, is sort of a Dennis Gartman, who you know pretty well up there in Canada. He had this saying once that said, told me, you want to, at some parts of the cycle, you want to buy things that hurt when you drop on your feet. Bonds do not hurt when you drop on your feet. Copper does. Iron ore does. So we're seeing some profit taking the commodities, and some of the mutual funds that invest in commodities are seeing some outflows. But in general, I'd say that's been where the rotation's been, out of tech, into financials, into commodities or commodities or materials, that kind of sector. But I think that what I think we lose sight of, as people like ourselves who watch the market every day, is that yes, there has been a rise in interest rates, but should last March really be our base case? We're talking about today, as we're speaking here, we've got the 10-year U.S. bond yield at 1.55%. CPI that's coming out next week in the U.S. is likely to be about 1.4%, 1.5%. Nominal interest rates are still low. So Germany, they've seen about a 28 basis point rise in the last couple of months. We're talking about minus 30 basis points. In Germany, we're talking about in Italy, 75 basis point yield, half of what it is in the U.S. So I think that while interest rates have risen, we're not really at high levels yet. They would really choke off an economy, choke off profitability for businesses. And so because of that, I sort of think that this correction, that's all it is, may have some more room to run. And like you say, it's almost like the reverse of last year. Weak economy, strong stock market. Now, strong economy and weaker stock market. You know, our NASDAQ has sold off now 10% from its record high that it made just a few weeks ago. And so we are in this area which, whether it's for people who like measure these things kind of in a correction, my sense is that it's still too early to pick a bottom to it, partly because I'm thinking about what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. I said a month from now, we might get a million job growth, non-farm payrolls. We haven't seen, you know, after we get past this fiscal stimulus the U.S. is talking about, close, it'll probably be past this coming weekend, that we're going to turn our attention to the infrastructure. And during the campaign, Biden promised over $1 trillion infrastructure program. There's some estimates that it might go up as high as $2 to $3 trillion. So I think that's too early to really pick a bottom to these. And I think that the fact that so many people are picking a bottom to it suggests to me that it hasn't been a capitulation, as painful as this has been.
All of this just screams to me a restart trade, an economic restart trade, a steepening yield curve, money flowing into some of the banks, base metals and commodities still doing pretty well, especially with the potential of an infrastructure bill, even as energy prices continue to move higher. Where does this all leave gold then? Because gold, again, weak this week and actually broke below 1700.
Yeah, huh? Gold is really a heartbreak for a lot of people. We think that gold is fueled by inflation or fueled by, you think sell-off stocks, that should be good for gold. But I think that gold is a sort of a strange character in general. I think that we should be looking, even though to me gold is terribly oversold, as it got below that $1,700 level. I look for a small bounce next week, but I'm not convinced the low is in place yet in gold, partly because what's the driver for the sell-off? I don't think it's about inflation per se. I think it's higher nominal yields. Partly when I turned bullish gold, thinking it would go to 2,000, we were around 1,400. And I thought that because I think the interest rates were going to continue to fall, and they, of course, they fell much further than I would have than I could have ever expected or imagined. But that interest rate, the falling interest rates, makes gold look relatively more attractive because gold does not generate a yield. And so now that yields are rising, and I don't think we're like I say, we shouldn't be picking a top to the yields or like a bottom to bonds. And that just tells me that gold could have a little bit of a bounce, maybe at 1720, 1730, something like that. But I think that the next leg down brings us probably closer to 1600, which is a psychological level. There's some chart levels there as well as some retracement levels. So I think that we need to be careful of gold. For me, I think it's just a question of the discipline of what is driving it, what's driving the market we're looking at. I happen to think that interest rates are driving gold. And because interest rates are rising, I think that's negative for gold.
It's as simple as that, and it usually is, unfortunately. Well, Mark, we're going to wrap it up here. Thanks for taking some time on this weekend show. It's another crazy and wild week, but very interesting to see the way that these markets look like they're going to close up for the day. And actually, some of the swings we've seen have been fairly positive. Maybe that buy the dip mentality is still very prevalent in U.S. markets. Mark, great chatting with you, buddy. I'll chat with you again next week. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks. Good luck to everybody.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
Welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And in this segment, as promised, we are getting a bit more into the energy sector as I am chatting with Joseph Schatcher, founder and editor of the Schatcher Energy Report, and also writes the free newsletter Eye on Energy, which provides you an update on some of the fundamentals broadly in the oil and energy market. Joseph, I think we have to start with the OPEC Plus meeting and surprise announcement that OPEC Plus was not increasing production. That surprised the market and moved the oil price higher. Oil had a very strong end to the week. And as you and I are recording this late in the day on Friday, oil is crude, at least, is over $66 a barrel. Look, there's a lot of interest in oil, especially when you consider just last year, oil was in negative territory. Joseph, give us a little background or some insights on what you took away from that OPEC Plus meeting.
Yeah, my pleasure, Corey. The basic assumption that the community had before the OPEC announcement was that OPEC would raise production in April by 500,000 for the whole of OPEC Plus, and that would include Russia. And then the Saudis would talk about how they were going to bring back the million barrels that they said they cut back for the months of February and March. Now, in February, they only cut back 850,000, so they didn't get to the full million. We're going to see that data next week when we get the OPEC report coming out. But the big thing now is, of course, that they're not going to increase and bring that volume back. They have given 130,000 barrels more to the Russians, I think 20,000 to Kazakhstan. But what they're missing is that while you may have 800,000 barrels not coming on the market, you have demand falling by 2 to 2.5 million barrels once winter is over. So demand might have been 94 million barrels in January and February. that number is going to come down to 91.5, 92, maybe 93 during the months of March, April, and May and June, and then it'll only pick up to 94, 95 when we get into the summer driving season. So the amount of inventory build, which is normally at this time of year, March, April, May, June, is going to happen again. And it may not be as much as it would have been if the OPEC had raised production, but the bottom line is we're going to see inventories build. Last week, for example, or the week, Wednesday, the inventories built commercial by 21.6, and you had gasoline down by 13.6, and you had distillates down by 9. So effectively, there was no build. But people don't realize that the U.S. production is now coming back in Texas. It was up by 300,000 barrels to 10 million from 9.7. That's still down by 3.1 million, and about a million of that is related to the Texas winter storm, which will probably bring these volumes back up as electricity and everything gets hooked up again. And so I think you're going to see both rising inventories in the next couple of months, and you're going to see U.S. rising production. And if these prices stay up, the U.S. shale industry is going to take off again, not by the large public multinational companies, but the private equity companies and the private companies that don't have this quarterly performance game and who are the ones who sold out, a couple of years ago to the big boys. They started new companies, and now they're growing. And you can see that even from the rig count. We had an increase in the rig count in the Permian this week. So we're beginning to see, in my book, a good reason to be sellers. We've been saying that for a little while. Take advantage of it. Some stocks have gone a bit higher than where we said sell. Others are down, 5, 10% from that. So it's a churning, topping market here. And for people who are invested in the sector, my best recommendation would be is you've got some great gains from the lows that we had in March of 2020. If you are in that position, definitely this is euphoric territory, and harvesting some of those gains makes a lot of sense.
Okay, so you are seeing pressure come back into this market, but in all fairness, I know from talking to you, this market has gone a lot farther than you even thought that it could, and myself as well. I did not think that oil would be consistently rising this much, but there is also this component of the economic restart trade that is happening, and some of the states that are opening up. Could this mentality, could this enthusiasm help support oil at these general levels?
It has been, and you saw the this week the jobs number that came out, which was positive. So you've got a big increase. A lot of those are service related jobs because those parts of the economy are being reopened, and so people are optimistic. The problem is the caseload is picking up again. The pandemic numbers are getting worse again, and you're seeing new cases, new mutations. The UK one, the South African one, the Brazilian one. I think if we do see more pickup in the caseload and in more worse, not do you want, the fatality count, I think that's going to cool the jets of what's going on here right now. This, to me, is very frothy. Stocks are gapping up today, 5, 10%. And the reality is, if you put in and you say we're going to be $66 through the end of 21, you could argue these stocks still have upside. But if you believe that the price of oil has got $15, $20 of froth in it and should be in the 50 range or less, which is my view based on the fundamentals, that would mean, that we should see at some point some kind of a, let's say, some black swan that surprises everybody, be it a pickup in U.S. production, be it the fact that China's not as much of a buyer because they didn't do their lunar holiday. They had everybody not traveling versus their normal travel, so their inventories are high. And so if they stop buying, and that could be the surprise that the market isn't focusing on right now. So I don't know what the reason is going to be that we're going to see a reversal of the price movement we've seen. But we were at $50 in early February, and so we've gone from 50 to 66. Part of it was frothy commercial, speculative money coming into the futures market. The Robin Hood Reddit came in and moved the price of crude from 50 to 58. And then the freeze in Texas and the shutting of U.S. production took it to 62, 63. And then this last $3-4 up on the upside has been because of the OPEC agreement. I'm looking forward to seeing the OPEC data next week because, number one, I want to see, that what Saudi Arabia officially did was at 850 or, in terms of the cutback. And then I want to see the cheating by Venezuela and Iran, and I want to see what Iraq did. And so if we see that those other numbers are going up and nobody's talking about those because everybody just says Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia, then I think we're going to see a reversal of this wonderful rally that we've seen. And my view is, if you've got great gains, you may not get the first 10% of a move or the last 10% of a move, but if you pick up the big chunk of it, which we did, that to me is acceptable and a win, fabulous win.
All right, well, let's drive down into some of the stocks then, because the stocks have done pretty well, obviously, on the back of this move, but I've still heard some of the arguments that the stocks have generally lagged, which does make some of the other commentators I've had on the show a bit cautious, kind of in your camp as well. What's some of the moves and some of the data you've seen within these stocks as well?
Well, the ones that are moving now are the ones with the bad balance sheets, the most leveraged ones, because they have a lot of debt. And of course, with these higher commodity prices, they're generating more cash flow. So if everybody starts discounting these prices and say they're going to stay, if you remember models going back a while ago, we're using for the whole year of this year, $55 WTI, which is what I have in my model. So if you plug in 66, all of a sudden there's a massive new amount of cash flow. That debt to cash flow for these high debt companies starts coming down. That's why those are the stocks that are running right now. My view is that if we reversed back down and we get to 50, and then the average for the year is 55 or so, these stocks are way ahead of themselves. So the value I see is more on the natural gas side, because I think natural gas prices will stay up longer. And so, the scenario is more bullish for natural gas because of LNG exports in the States, stronger demand in Western Canada, and new pipeline takeaway capacity from Canada into the States. And the U.S. right now has a shortage of natural gas. That's why we've been seeing these big drawdowns. So I think the natural gas stocks on any correction are going to be your best values. And that's where we're thinking when we begin to buy again, we'll be looking at the natural gas stories. We also think the energy service stocks have had a beautiful run, but if they correct, they would also maybe give you another great buying opportunity. I'm less bullish on the heavier barrels of oil because I think those are the ones that are going to see the biggest spread. The WCS will widen out, and with the U.S., with President Biden wanting to, the XL pipeline issues, which we've seen, the issue now of Line 5, there's going to be a problem with getting product into the United States. And then if rail needs to be done, then you need to cover the cost of rail, which means if the price of oil is, let's say, 60 and the rail goes, is worth $20, that means then the net back at the WCS price will come down. That, I think, is not in the market right now. And if Line 5 gets shut in, which is the battleground you may have seen this week in the papers, where the Canadian government is working with the U.S. over this issue. And Biden, of course, wants his environmental credentials. And you've got the governor of Michigan against it. And some of the tribal groups there and the environmental lobby. I think people are not looking at some of these wild cards that could be quite negative.
Okay. So really, you are just cautious in this market, right? You're waiting for a pullback. When you talk about pullback and a better buying opportunity, what does that look like percentage-wise or even price level-wise? How far, how fast could these things drop?
Well, if we get down below 50 in WTI, then you're looking at a 20%, 25% decline in the commodity price. I don't think natural gas prices go down maybe more than 10%. So that's why I think natural gas is, if you're staying exposed, stay exposed natural gas wise. But if I'm right, you could see the S&P TSX Energy Index, which is right now, you know, sitting today at, let me forget that number, at 120, it could go down to 60. So it could be a 50% decline. It's up, you know, up 3% on today, but, you know, could it go down 50%? Yes. Just pull out a long-term chart and you can see this kind of, you know, movement. That's the kind of large moves that, the oil sector can do, both positively, which it's done right now. It's, you know, because it's gone from 60 to where it is now. And it's, you know, it was 38 in March of 2020. And could it go back to the 60 where we saw just a few months ago? I think it can.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. It's been a wild market for energy and oil in particular. So we'll see how it all plays out. But the surprise announcement this week did come out of OPEC Plus, and it did move the price higher. Joseph, it's great chatting with you. I really appreciate you taking time on this weekend show. I'll chat with you in about another month to get an update on the oil sector. In the meantime, I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. All right, welcome back. Here we are wrapping up the weekend edition of the KE Report. And in this segment, I am featuring Tier 1 Silver. Now, I do get a lot of questions about this company, mostly asking, when is it going to be listed and tradable? We will get to that answer coming up in this interview. I am joined right now by Ivan Bebek, co-founder and co-chairman, and also Peter Dembicki, the new president and CEO at Tier 1 Silver. Now, guys, as I mentioned, I've received a lot of questions, especially on the back of closing the financing for just short of $13.5 million, which was up from $10 million initially announced. Ivan, I want to start off with a big picture look then at the spin-out company, Tier 1 Silver. There is also another spin-out in Peru that we'll talk about in future interviews. And on the back of that spin-out, also Fury Gold Mines was created. Now, Ivan, you mentioned when the companies were being spun out that you were looking to unlock value in some of these assets that weren't carrying the same amount of value or getting the same amount of attention that you thought they deserved when they were all under the Orin brand. Give us an update now of where these companies stand after the spin out and how you think value has been unlocked, please.
Thanks, Corey. It's great to be back. It's no shortage of probably the busiest 6 months of our careers, splitting Orin into three. There's been a lot of changes, especially with Tier 1 Silver, since we split Orin into three companies on October 9th. I did advocate that there would be considerable value added into Tier 1 between that October 9th date and when we would relist. And that comes in a few different ways. Most importantly, our Curry-Baya project has wowed us and really knocked us off the chair with excitement. And we are now looking at something that's developed into what we're describing as the best undrilled, high-grade, large-scale silver potential discovery globally, and that's where it ranks with us, which is a very large statement. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, today. Subsequent to that kind of revelation, we did receive drill permits on December 28th, which is amazing. For those of you who have followed us through the Peruvian, you know, fairly lengthy process to get permits, we achieved those during COVID, and we also achieved those during some political turmoil in Peru with the election. So no delay there. We got those on time, in fact, early. And most importantly, we got a new CEO that joined our group, Peter Dembicki, who's with us today. I've known Peter since the early days, since elementary school, actually, and I followed his career when he was a broker at Canaccord Genuity, one of the largest brokerage firms in Canada. Peter was at the top of his career, and you know, when we looked for this CEO for Tier 1 Silver, we didn't need another geologist. We certainly have what we argue is one of the better technical teams globally. And between Sean and myself, we're both very comfortable on the corporate aspects of the company. But as we split one company into three, the one place we wanted to beef up kind of our management was on the monetization capital markets aspect. And so Peter comes to us with a wealth of experience. He also has a unique background is a world champion rower. He won the world championship in rowing. And why that's important to us is not because we're going to row, but it's more to do with his work ethic. And if you want to meet somebody that's extremely determined, ambitious, driven, and professional, that's what you get with Peter. So off to a great start, got drill permits. The portfolio has grown for Tier 1 Silver, and it's, you know, we just completed that funding at a very good valuation that we think is just the start of what's to come.
So, Peter, let's bring you in here. Ivan did provide a bit of a background there, but give us an update of what attracted you to join Tier 1 and, even more importantly, the group that is behind Tier 1 Silver.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me. It was a big decision for me to switch careers. 40 years old, I had an amazing 10 plus years at Canaccord. I did leave at the top of my career, but it really was first and foremost the people that drew me to the Tier 1 group, formerly Orin. You know, anytime I had clients investing in any of the deals or companies that I would recommend to anyone, there are a few points that I'd have to check off the box. One, have they done it before? Well, in the case of Ivan and Sean, yes, they've done it a couple times in good markets and bad. Two, operations, in the case of an exploration team, that's our technical team. Really is the best technical team I've seen in any exploration company out there. So that provided me with a lot of confidence. Three, you know, it's our shareholder base that we have inherited from Orin is so incredibly strong. They are such great loyal shareholders. They understand the business of exploration. So, you know, these kind of check boxes that you check off down the list is something that I would have put all my clients into at the time. And for Ivan to give me the tap and to bring me into the family, it's an honor. And now that I'm here, I see the efficiency, how everybody's working, and obviously the potential of our flagship project. I couldn't be more excited. We are firing on all cylinders here.
All right, Ivan, let's bring you back in and let's talk about the flagship project then. Curry Baya, you and I have talked about this in the past, but now that permits are received, there's a clear path to some near-term catalyst when it comes to drilling. What is the attack strategy going to be here?
Well, the favorite part of that answer is going to be drilling to see if we've got it, you know, one of these massive discoveries. And, you know, quick little overview. Curry Baya started with high-grade silver, and it got better and better and better. And so what we have is a 20-kilometer alteration system running several veins, multiple veins coming out of one source. They're running, 80 of them run above half kilo silver up to 300 kilo silver, which is absolutely astounding in terms of metal budget. Then there's gold veins as well, and 60 of them are running from 2 grams to 934 gram gold. So these veins are all emanating from one spot in the middle of this massive 20-kilometer alteration system. Before I get into what happens beneath the surface, real quickly, we age dated the alteration system because we are on the belt of some of the largest mines, porphyry mines in the world, such as Quellaveco, Tocopala, Cajone, and Cerro Verde. And we actually age-dated our alteration system to the same as those. And that's paramount when thinking about world-class discoveries. You need to be in that same era of the event that occurred for those mines. So to jump to the chase, what happens underneath all this silver and gold on surface with these incredible grades? We got a 700 to 750 meter window of targets for just precious metal. This would include, actually, there is now, you'll see soon, some open pit targets. But there's going to be stockwork veins in the top 120 meters, and we'll look for a series of those together to form an economic type of scenario. And then we get into about 200 to 300 meters of feeder structures that are in rocks that are much more permissible to host big, thick veins, type of vein structures. And then we get into a very big disseminated target for the last 400 meters of that vertical kind of window. And, you know, we don't know, like we could drill anywhere from, you know, 5-10 meters of a kilo silver up to 300 meters of a kilo silver. Those are the kind of possibilities that we're seeing in our targeting. You know, listening to some of the former Newmont world experts that are on our board, as well as our team there, you know, the classification is the size and the amount of targets that exist here for a big precious metal system are astounding to them. And it's something that's unique. it's something that hasn't been seen in a considerable amount of time, and there's really no strong analogous mine to it. Underneath all of that, that first 750 meters, we overlap into a big intrusion. And if you understand much about the technical world of how the geology works, generally there's an event that created the system of epithermal, you know, deposits or grade that comes to surface. And that sometimes can be a porphyry. And because we're on the belt of these massive porphyries, we have to be porphyry minded and think, wow, what if this intrusion is a big porphyry? And you go from precious metal system and you drill a 1,000 meters or two of porphyry after that. I mean, grade is going to be the number one question and risk. That could also be an epithermal intrusion where it could be continuous precious metals. But, you know, what I've just described to you was one of the biggest or the biggest target I've seen in 21 years of being in this business. It's never been drilled before. The lottery is going to be the grade, the grade and the width. You know, we've mapped some of the widths to be considerable through geophysics, but what's the grade going to be? Are we going to be drilling tens of meters of a kilo silver, 100 gram silver, or 200-300 kilo silver like we've seen on surface? So it's really a truly, you know, one of those rare opportunities. I hate and I like the cliche of once in a lifetime, but this is the first for me, and it probably be the last as an epithermal system that hasn't been drilled with this kind of endowment potential on a world-class belt.
All right. So Peter, Ivan clearly has the big picture in mind here. A lot of targets, a lot of potential. Give us a few more of the nuances of this drill program. When's it going to start? What's the budget going to be? What more can you tell us about what the attack strategy is when those drills are on site?
Yeah, as soon as possible. I mean, we are overly excited about getting drills to the property, getting work done as we speak. So we're anticipating commencing drilling at the end of April, and we could possibly hope for results anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks following our first drills.
So the company's headline here in the presentation says pursuing world-class silver and gold discoveries in southern Peru, discoveries being plural. Now, the company does have a couple other projects, but what is the balance here? Obviously, Curibaya is the focus, but how are you going to balance out these other projects? And is there potential here for more acquisitions to come into the company?
Yeah, absolutely. We do have a couple other projects in our portfolio. And the reason why we've done that is for a couple of reasons. One, you know, we often get the question, well, if Curibaya is so special, you know, why are you bothering with other projects? Well, for a number of reasons. We want to give our shareholders, our investors, multiple opportunities at world-class swings, multiple opportunities of finding that discovery along with us. And it always helps to mitigate the risk as well. I mean, mining exploration is a risky business. So we're doing it for those two reasons. And yes, you can expect more for us down the road. We'll be excited to share more about those projects as we go along.
So Ivan, I know you want to weigh in on this one. Give us your insights then on how you see the multiple projects playing into the overall company strategy, please.
Yeah, Peter couldn't have said that much better. I agree full-heartedly in mitigating the risk, getting those kind of huge swings that we all envy as shareholders to be part of. What happens if we get more than one of them, instead of splitting the company again, because I can testify to how much work that is, we would probably look to spin and sell versus to spin and run new companies. Great CEOs are very difficult to find. We found two of them in the last few months or last 6 months, and we're very fortunate to have them. But, you know, I think to Peter's point, mitigating the risk and giving more swings. And, you know, if we can be a repeat offender, I know other people have done this before in a good way ahead of us, such as Ross Beatty. If we can repeat success with multiple discoveries in this bull market that's in front of us, I think we would have really crushed it for our shareholders and for our share price going forward.
So Ivan, as I mentioned, the company did just raise almost $13.5 million, up from $10 million that was announced. The price was set at $1. I've had some questions come in asking, what caused the company to set the price here? Because it isn't public, right? So how did you guys go about setting this price, which then leads into a market valuation here of the company of over $100 million?
Well, two things there. You know, when setting the price, that's obviously a choice that management is provided the difficulty or the luxury of making. We measured a few things. We measured the investment demand, which was substantial, and that's why we increased our funding. If you read our press release there, you saw that We only increased it because of the quality of investors that were coming to us, not so much because we wanted to take more money at the time. We watched dilution very carefully, and we even more importantly, watch who our shareholder base is, because that's our strength and we appreciate all our shareholders. We were probably took about half of what was being offered to us, to be really honest about it. And our mechanism of finance was a private placement, which has a 4-month hold for Canadians, a 6-month hold for Americans. And this is what eliminates all the hedge funds, and a lot of different investment funds won't buy into private deals like this. So even with that kind of hurdle, we had an incredible amount of interest and demand. And what it's fueled from, and what everyone can be excited to be towards, is the confidence that's growing in Kuribaya and the team and the other assets in the portfolio. And we're not going to talk too much about, you know, Emilia, the Coastal Bathleth, or other acquisitions today, because Kuribaya overshadows everything at its current state. It's ready to go. It's ready to drill. But these will be things in the background that we bring forward. So reminding you of what Orin traded at, as we were a company with assets both in Canada and Peru, we were trading as high as $300-400 million, you know, dollar market cap. And I'm aware that there's ounces at Homestake and, you know, in Committee Bay and whatnot. But in Peru, what we've done with Tier One is we've created the same, you know, portfolio approach. It's very focused. The projects we're going for can be permitted in a very timely manner. It took 5 months to permit, or 5.5 months to permit Kuribaya start to finish. And we're going to keep very live, meaning there should be drill program after drill program for the next few years to give these kind of discoveries, right? So we picked a number that was in the middle. We could have raised money higher. As shareholders, we lean for that. As investors, I'm sure people wanted it lower, and we still cut back a considerable amount of people at a dollar Canadian. The market cap, it's big for some, but it's small for us based on what we're trying to achieve. And what I mean by that is, if we get this right and we're finding and drilling, you know, 10 or 20 meters of kilos of silver underneath the surface, you know, I think getting to a multi-billion dollar market cap would be very, very, very realistic in the upcoming silver, anticipated silver market. I think we could really crush it that way. So from that perspective, I think the pricing was very fair. I think that in some ways, I think it was cheap, but we got really good investors. And I qualify it as being cheaper because of how big the opportunity is. So look for a lot of growth out of us. And, you know, there's a lot of risk behind what I'm talking about. I'm very aware of that. But the bigger the risk, the bigger the reward. And here, having an undrilled project that can be a new discovery, something that's never been drilled before on such a big prolific belt with such incredible grade, is truly the kind of investment that makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck as you look forward to waiting for those drill results.
Well, clearly the demand was there too, so that needs to speak to I think all of our listeners. One other quick question then, just over to you, Peter. When will the listing happen of Tier One Silver? I have a lot of people asking that.
I was hoping you were going to tell me that. I'm just joking. We are. It is as soon as possible. We are working every single day, and we're anticipating in March to be listed on the TSX Venture. But really, it's just working with the exchange. So it's on a as soon as possible basis, really.
Okay. Guys, to wrap this up, I want to get a little comment from both of you regarding the markets, clearly taken from slightly different sides. Peter, you come from the broker background. Ivan, more on the company side, although Peter, now you're on the company side. Peter, let's start with you. Clearly, precious metals, more gold than silver, has been under some pressure, and some of the stocks have, most of the stocks have actually been dipping. What are you seeing in terms of market sentiment and overall interest in precious metals when it comes from now being on the company side of things?
Absolutely. So there's so many different ways to go about it and to look at it from an investment standpoint. What are the macroeconomic effects that are moving precious metals around? With silver, the one thing I do love is that there is a huge use case for it. I mean, we have the United States presenting one of the largest checks being written to enhance their renewable energy sector and infrastructure as we move away from fossil fuels. Well, you know, the amount of silver that is going to be required to fulfill that demand and need is astronomical, and it far outweighs what's being produced right now. All the electronics and electric vehicles and batteries and solar panels all have an incredible amount of silver in there. So I love it from that standpoint. And then obviously on a speculative level, you know, precious metals, I really do believe we're heading into a massive commodity cycle. You know, day by day, it's hard not to get caught up in the price swings of precious metals. But really, if you look at it and just stand back and say, okay, where are we heading for the next 10 years? You know, I find it's going to be an incredible investment.
Ivan, give us a little insights. I know you all are always watching the markets very closely. What are your thoughts on the current state of the precious metals market?
Great question. Well, first off, for the first time in my career, this sell-off did not bother me, you know, except for the share price. And I don't like to see investors frustrated and impatient and feel panic, right? However, we've been through so many waves as we enter the bull market. And to be honest, if gold had been through 2,300 right now, and we were on our way to 2,500, I would have been more anxious and more concerned, because we would have been in the final stages of this bull market and the mania that's coming. So I don't mind the sell-off. I think that if you listen to the macro picture, if you listen to the money printing that's ahead, to comments Peter just made with respect to stimulus and fiscal policy in the U.S. and the green energy plan that's coming, you know, we all know where this gold bull market is going. I mean, Goldman Sachs and everyone else is calling for this super mania. But before that, to see a big sell-off, the bid kind of pulled on the market is really not uncommon. It will create some liquidity for a lot of people that are going to look to come into a very small market. And so for me, if this did not happen, I would have worried that we were in the wrong point of cycle. So it confirms it. As far as stocks go, you know, how often do I look at the tape? I honestly look at our share price is once a day at this being fury, because it's the one trading. I don't look at the share price more than once a day, and I don't look at the metal prices more than once a day, because I'm a big picture thinker, and our plan is so fundamentally aligned with the big picture that we just put our heads down and we drive the business forward. Now, as the wind gets sucked out of the market, you know, gold has sold off for two consecutive weeks. It's the most emotional investment you can make. It affects all commodities because it does have that much emotional impact. And when it slides like that, share prices tend to fall off cliffs, and the buyers, they don't leave necessarily the space. They just pull back and wait on the sidelines. So I know of a lot of large investors looking for the bottom here. It's definitely a buyer's market. I do sense a turn coming. I think what's going to drive the turn outside of U.S. Treasury yields and whatnot is going to be the next quarter from all the majors that have enjoyed the $1,900 gold price in Q4. Oil prices have not gone up too far. The cost of people has not inflated too much at all. So I still think we have some record quarters to come out of all these majors and mid-tier producing mining companies, which puts the spotlight on the one thing that matters most for us is who's finding metal, where are you going to find a big deposit, and what are you going to get paid for finding it? And I think for everyone's discomfort, it's incredibly hard to make these discoveries. You know, there's a series of companies that will go out there and they'll redrill the same thing and try to make you convince you it's better. But the real thing that this market needs and that everyone needs to see is a major discovery of consequence, something new that hasn't been drilled before. And, you know, being in that position with Committee Bay and also new targets around Eau Claire and Fury is outstanding for the gold side of the business. In silver, I mean, silver is something that I've wanted to be part of my entire career, because it trades at twice the P multiple of gold because of the leverage to the silver price. And so what Curibaya became and how it came together was not a good silver property. It came out as a spectacular silver swing. And we'll publish a cool fly-through video soon that will show people a lot of, you know, facts and evidence behind our enthusiasm. And lastly, copper. Copper is the future most strategic metal on the planet due to its use in vehicles, renewable energy, and better building materials and so on. And the shortage of copper and the demand supply is not going to be fixed by a big discovery, because it takes anywhere from 12 to 20 years to build a new big discovery into an actual mining scenario. So there is low-grade copper mines around the world that will never produce the tonnage or the amount of pounds of copper needed. And I think that we're going to enjoy a slow, you know, steady copper rising market for the next few decades to come. I think silver could go completely parabolic, much like described by recent people, not $1,000 an ounce, but $40 or $50 an ounce silver. And it's going to be extremely good times for silver companies. And as far as gold, I've been a gold bug my entire career. The volatility before a big move to the upside is essential. It's happening. It sucks when it's down, but if you focus on the big picture, as long as the companies you're investing into have two things: improving fundamentals and have cash, have a treasury to weather this downturn in this corner, you're safe, you know, in my opinion. I think it's a very, very good time to be ambitious with purchases of companies you like of quality. So be bullish, stay bullish on the big macro picture. Don't worry about the micro picture. Let the stocks be volatile. Just make sure the fundamentals are going the right way, which they are in our group of companies. So we're very excited.
Okay, guys, we're going to wrap it up here. I appreciate you taking time on this weekend show. I also thank everybody for tuning in, listening to the weekend show and to all the daily editorials throughout this week. If any of you have any follow-up questions for Tier 1 Silver or any of the other companies that I have chatted with this week, please just email me, fleck@kereport.com. I will get those addressed for you, and be sure to check out throughout the week all the daily editorials covering some of the market action that continues to be quite volatile and quite crazy. This week was one, again, to remember, unfortunately for the precious metals, but also for the broad averages and some of the moves we saw, some of the weakness that came in at the end of the week. Guys, thank you again for your time. Everybody, I hope you have a great weekend.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.